Welcome to the OnFit Podcast.
Thank you very much for listening to this podcast. I am Ellie Groves. I'm the Deputy Head of Programming here at OnFit and also the Europe Manager for our programming. I'm very pleased to be joined by Natalia Ospina, who is Research Assistant here at OnFit. We're going to be giving a short overview on what has happened this quarter at OnFit in our meetings and our bulletins and our research. It's been an incredibly jam-packed quarter. We have moved our meetings on to the online virtual formats as of about a year ago from the COVID-19 crisis. We have since had conversations on the initial response to this crisis, and this quarter has been looking quite heavily at the recovery, along with some of our other themes on the Digital Money Institute and the Sustainable Policy Institute. So I'm very pleased Natalia is here, who will be able to offer some thoughts on the research a little bit later on. But Natalia, I think you had a couple of questions as well to kick us off with.
Yes, Ellie. Thank you very much for that brief introduction. Now, as you have mentioned, we have held a large number of virtual meetings over the last quarter. I was wondering if you could mention which ones have stood out and what have been the overarching themes. Let's start maybe with the EU.
Thank you very much. Exactly. I'm very pleased to start with Europe. It's my main area of focus at OnFit, although do cover a lot of the other areas too. What we've actually seen in this last quarter is we've heard from a fair few European countries, from Spain, France, Germany, Italy. We've also heard from Czech Republic, Hungary and Poland with their deputy governors at the national banks, as well as the ECB and Commission, from the German ambassador to the UK to the head of the Treasury in France and the chief economist at the National Bank of Spain. We've really been delving into the recovery post-COVID, which each nation is looking into and responding. But what's been really interesting is that on top of this, you've seen the different perspectives from each speaker on the increasing fiscal union in Europe and the role of the Next Generation EU Fund. I think we will see Europe change over the next few years off the back of how the crisis has been handled. Immediately, we saw a real push for solidarity and a European collective response to the crisis. This is partly because it's been prevalent in every single country, and every country needed to hold the line of solidarity, which I think has been really interesting. Of course, in the mix of this, we've had Brexit, which has also potentially had a really strong view on how the countries in Europe have responded to the crisis, but also how Europe and the UK build a relationship post-January. So we've had a few meetings looking at that. I think one of the things that we'll be watching is how each country comes out of the crisis and where there is a sectorial and country divergence in the growth and where the frictions and conversations will start up again. You've got the election in Germany coming up this year as well, and the relationship in the EU between kind of being German-centric or French-centric, which I think will be a very interesting thing to watch. We've seen a lot of focus on when there might be path back to normalization, but I think the big question is, what does normal look like? Will we have a rewriting of the European fiscal rules, or will we go back to the Maastricht Treaty, which has been temporarily suspended in an emergency environment? So I think that those are things that we have been discussing and will continue to discuss. A couple of podcasts, if I may, just have a moment on. We've had a really interesting discussion with Otmar Issing and Lord Mervyn King on the ECB future direction and central bank independence. The podcast looked at some of the themes I've touched on earlier, but actually this one really delved into the roles of fiscal and monetary policy, how they work together, and how central banks are potentially at risk of being responsible for things outside their mandate. In particular, this podcast threw up some interesting perspectives on the climate agenda. But I think we also had another one looking at the strategy review and the road ahead for the ECB with Francesco Papadia and Bill Papadakis, who looks at what the ECB has in its competency and what the strategy review might throw up for future role of central banks. We had Italy's G20 priorities with Alessandro Riviera from the Ministry of Economy and Finance in Italy. Mark Sobel, our US chairman, interviewed him, really delving into tax policies and financial regulation priorities post-COVID, but also how Italy wants to shape that conversation as president of the G20 this year. We've had a lot of coverage on Germany. As I said, it's a key year for Germany, but also Germany being so integral in the EU architecture. It's been a very interesting discussions that we've had about Germany's thoughts on the PEPP program, so on the quantitative easing from the ECB, and how that might play out in the future discussions on the fiscal union that I spoke of in Europe. So that's a very broad summary of everything that we've been covering. As you can see, we've been having meetings each week on these areas. So please do take a look at our past meetings, our on-demand page, because a lot of these discussions have either been on the record, or if they've been off the record, we've had a lot of commentaries which discuss the themes.
Oh, well, thank you, Ellie, very much for this very wide overview of the EU. Now, tell me a little bit what we covered this first quarter about the US.
Exactly. And I would again say that a lot of our US coverage has been thematic, and it's obviously looked at closely at the Biden administration and how this will look compared to the last 4 years. COVID recovery has been a strong theme here too. We've had a meeting with Patricia Mosser, who is Columbia University, and Mary Miller, who's the former Undersecretary for Domestic Finance at the US Treasury Department. We had Richard Berner also join that conversation, again, former director of the Office of Financial Reporting in the US. And this really looks at the financial stability risk, where they think that the FSOC and the OFR need to focus on post-COVID recovery, but also what are the key Biden administration priorities. I think another really interesting thing that we've been discussing with our Asia team and also with the US is the relationship between the US and China. This discourse has strongly suggested that under President Biden, we will see a return to usual rules apply on the international stage. But that still has an interesting degree of relationship with China and how this trade and economic relationship plays out in the domestic sphere is very important, but also it's important to the rest of the globe, especially on how Europe has a relationship with both US and China. So there is a huge geopolitical interconnectivity here. We had an interesting meeting on this, was held on the 10th of February, which was looking at geopolitical outlook for the US-China relationship under Biden. You can find that on our on-demand page. But you can also not miss out the Fed discussions that we've had and their recovery plan. As I said, we've had lots of central banks from Europe discussing the recovery plan. We have not missed this in our US coverage either. We've had the Vice President and Director of Research at the Federal Reserve Bank of Richmond and also the Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City to really map out the Fed's plan for US recovery. A recovery which has wide implications for the rest of the world. It has a huge amount of inflation consequences too. So there will be more in that, those discussions throughout the rest of this year too. I think that at this point, I want to bring you, Natalia, into some of the conversations that we've had around research. I think focused in these opening remarks and shown that OnFIF has had a real coverage on COVID recovery, inflation, and the fiscal and monetary policy interplay to how there'll be global growth following the global pandemic. But I think that we also have the court this year really focused on the SPI, so the Sustainable Policy Institute, especially in our research. But before we do, we've had a bulletin this quarter as well, which I know covers both the SPI focus, but also some of the things that I mentioned. So perhaps, Natalia, could you go into the bulletin a little bit and we will circle back to the SPI?
Yes, sure, Ellie. Thank you very much. So this year's first bulletin covered, as usual, a wide range of topics. So there are very interesting pieces around some of the subjects you've just mentioned, like inflation and central bank independence, which I'm not going to repeat. But the bulletin also covers other very interesting topics, which I think we have not yet touched upon. For example, one of them is the euro reserve currency status. We had Frank Scheide from DZ Bank writing an article pointing out that euro-denominated debt asset classes is becoming for the first time a serious challenger to U.S. treasuries and a true alternative for institutional investors. He makes it clear, though, that the dollar is still a long way from being dethroned, mainly because while a sufficient volume of euro-denominated sovereign bonds is available, yet the short end of the maturity curve is not adequately covered, as there are not enough short-term sovereign euro instruments with maturities of a year or less, of which there are many U.S. Treasury bills, as you may know. Now, closely related to this, the bulletin also covered the ever more important subject of sovereign debt. We all know that efforts to contain the fallout of the pandemic have led to unprecedented levels of public debt. And while some, like the German Supreme Audit, has made a call to policymakers to lower the, as they call it, inappropriately high government's deficit, others, like the IMF, have urged governments to refrain from withdrawing fiscal stimulus prematurely. So on this subject, we had Christian Kopp from Union Investment write a piece in the bulletin on the aspects that will determine public debt sustainability, and he touched upon growth trends of both the economic output and the price level, the borrowing rates, and the government's deficit levels. Also, I would like to mention that for members of the audience that are interested in probing into this very important topic, OMFIF is going to have a conference on June 8th on the future of sovereign debt management. The conference will convene debt management officers, investors, and intermediaries to discuss the hurdles and solutions on financing sovereign debt and the structural challenges to sustainable debt management. So I urge you all to write it down in your calendars right now.
Thank you so much. Thank you for bringing that event out as well. One of the things that we're going to discuss in that event is the growth of green bonds as well and how the climate agenda is addressed. I mentioned earlier about the Next Generation EU fund, and I think that the green agenda is really closely linked to European, US and global growth, something that we have, as I mentioned earlier, really focused on this quarter as well. We had our SPI journal and also a fair few seminars on this, discussions and reports. So I would like to ask you, Natalia, could you go into a little bit more detail on the focus that we've had on the sustainable policy and our Sustainable Policy Institute?
Yes, sure. And as you just mentioned, actually during this start of the year, we've had our SPI journal, a global seminar with DZ Bank that lasted more than a day, and several podcasts and meetings. And also in the next quarter, there are a lot more of this very important subject, especially in our meetings pipeline. But let me mention some of the subjects that OMFIF covered as part of the SPI during the last 3 months. On the SPI journal, for example, we highlighted how the enormous fiscal challenges that the handling of COVID-19 has brought upon governments has led to an increased awareness of the need to develop and implement solutions for risk financing to avoid similar fiscal constraints and financial constraints as a result of natural disasters, which we all know, of course, that we all only become more frequent and devastating if we continue down this road of global warming that we've been going on. So the SPI journal covered some alternatives to finance this risk. We mentioned the catastrophe market and how it has grown with the consistent increase in the volume of issuance of insurance-linked securities like the catastrophe bonds, such as the CAT bond issued by the Philippines in 2019. The journal also covered some very interesting articles on how the insurance sector can contribute to combating climate, and also on the development and implementation of market-based credit and disaster risk finance instruments through programs such as the Pacific Insurance and Climate Adaptation Program. Also, I would like to mention this event that we had with OMFIF, DZ Bank, and Union Investment that brought together policy experts from Asia, Europe, and the Americas in a global seminar to discuss effective ways of boosting sustainable investment and creating effective market structures to align with this net zero economy. As I mentioned, the discussion lasted almost 10 hours, so you can imagine the breadth of the interesting things we covered. Topics ranged from the implementation of the European Green Deal and the German Sustainable Finance Strategy to the role of green, social, and sustainable bonds on the recovery agenda and the future of sustainable finance more generally. For each of these three regional blocks, we discussed what was their role in the pursuit of realizing the sustainability agenda. And for example, in the Americas block, we had representatives from various institutions that have been active in sustainable finance issuance in capital markets, including the IMF, the World Bank, and CABE, the Central American Bank for Economic Integration, which actually was the first multilateral development bank to issue a corona bond, which we learned during that seminar. And just one last thing, let me briefly mention that we have worked very closely with CABE in our report that we published last year about Central American investment opportunities, which has a very interesting chapter especially dedicated on this aspect of sustainable finance.
Thank you so much. I want to move away from perhaps the environmental issues in ESG and look at the wider spectrum. We have the Gender Balance Index report, and it would be very interesting for you to offer a few more details on that. We released it in March, so please do offer the main findings that we've had in the 2021 GBI report.
Thanks, Ellie. So the GBI report has some very interesting findings this year, as well as some new additions. So I think the most striking finding is very well captured in the report's cover, and it's that out of the more than 500 institutions that we covered in the index, only three, so that's less than 1%, achieved a perfect gender balance score of 100. Now, regarding the new additions, the GBI report usually track the presence of men and women in decision-making positions in central banks, pension funds, and sovereign wealth funds. But now, in this year's edition, we have included commercial banks for the first time to be able to make comparisons between the public and the private sector. In doing this, we found that commercial banks achieved the highest score amongst all financial institutions, followed by central banks, then pension funds, and sovereign wealth funds occupied again this year the last place as the least balanced institution. Now, despite commercial banks having outperformed the others, there is still a long road ahead. So we found that only 15% of C-suite executives within these banks are women. And if we look down the path to prospective CEOs, we're struck with a really, really discouraging sight, as only 18% of women are currently running the most important business lines of what we called in the report the profit and loss divisions. And contrastingly, there are more women occupying administrative or operational roles within bank executive committees like human resources. Another very interesting finding in our 2021 report was how last year proved to be a missed chance to improve gender balance within central banks. So we mentioned that there were 31 central bank governors appointed last year, but only one was a woman, Vietnam's Nguyen Thi Hong. As part of the report's launch, OMFIF convened a panel with some very prominent speakers, including Tom Barking, the president of Federal Reserve Bank of Richmond, which, by the way, was the first central bank in the history of the GBI report to achieve a perfect score of 100. Now, the panel delved into some very interesting issues. It's also on the on-demand webpage of OMFIF. So they went from the ever-conflicting policy of quotas to the pros and cons of flexible working arrangements. Now, some important red flags were lifted that we need to consider, as many, at least here in the UK and in OMFIF, we're thinking of going back to the office. And if we want to keep this flexible arrangement in place, this needs to be monitored to avoid it reinforcing gender stigmas, was mentioned during the launch. For example, continuing to impose care responsibilities more on women than on men. And this could actually be the case if, for example, once people are given the chance to return to the office or stay working remotely, we see that women are the ones that opt to continue working from home, while men are the ones that return to the office. So these are some very interesting aspects that we touched upon.
Thank you. I think that they are extremely interesting. And as you say, please do watch the meeting back on our on-demand page, because the 8th report on the Gender Balance Index that we've done. So there is also some really interesting data that you can cross-reference through over the years as well, if you are so minded to do so. It's been definitely a key flagship report and meeting for OMFIF over the years. So it's been a very interesting one, and one that I know continues to grow. Talking of areas of OMFIF that are continuing to grow, we also don't want to neglect the Digital Money Institute, which launched last year and has had some really interesting discussions and journals out in this quarter as well. We will be focusing on the DMI Symposium next quarter, as that is a very important two-day event held in April. But I just want to ask you, Natalia, a little bit about the Institute and some highlights from these discussions in the Digital Money Journal, as well as some of the meetings that we've had around that.
Sure, Ellie. As we know, 2020 saw central banks' plans for digital currencies ramp up several notches. The DMI Journal took a deep dive into CBDC frontrunners, including the Bahamas with the rollout of its sand dollar, China's project of the Yuan, Swedish Krona pilot, and Singapore's project Yuvin. But as well as retail CBDC, the journal also discussed wholesale CBDC and the use of blockchain and DLT for banks. So, for example, it highlighted how this technology could alleviate pain points in cross-border payments and help to make them cheaper and more effective. The Digital Monetary Institute also convened some very interesting set of meetings during this first quarter, as you mentioned, Ali. So we had Christian Catalini, chief economist of the DM Association, as part of OMFIF's discussion about this stablecoin. Catalini revealed where DM is expected to sit within financial markets and how the stablecoin will overcome regulatory and structural hurdles. Members of the audience during that meeting were also giving some insights into the ongoing regulatory process of DM's payment license application, which I found fascinating. Its regulator is treating DM as a new bank, and as such, it has been required to follow closely Basel III capital requirements for its reserves and incorporate additional buffers to account for redemptions. This much-anticipated entrance of DM to the market has increased the attention of regulators on crypto assets in payment systems, and OMFIF has covered some of these aspects in its podcasts. We had Tim Mazad, former chairman of the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, discussing in OMFIF how regulators in the U.S. are addressing these concerns and how they are examining data protection, cybersecurity, and the need for a coordinated international approach to regulation supervision. We also took this discussion to Europe and did some podcasts. One of them was with Jan Sassens of the European Commission and Asen Kostadinov from Copper. So in this opportunity, the audience heard some insights into the intricacies of crypto assets and the legal framework proposed by the EU.
Thank you so much, Natalia. I want to bring this podcast towards its close. We've discussed some really interesting meetings that OMFIF has held, some relevant and engaging podcasts, and the themes have really been quite broad, but they have really focused, I think, on a sustainable COVID recovery and looking forward to the future and what future challenges will be faced, be that the climate change agenda, be that the digitalization and the digital money space. So I think we have done hopefully some justice in covering all of the different areas. There is always more, so do check out the OMFIF website. And to continue the discussions, our meetings will continue with a European focus on COVID recovery. We'll be looking at how these countries are managing the debt taken on due to the crisis. As Natalia mentioned, the meeting on the 8th of June, as I think is definitely one to watch with the debt management offices across Europe. We have Massimo Rastingolo from the ECB to discuss the strategy review along with other top ECB figures throughout the next few months. We have the Swiss National Bank and the Treasury in Ireland to discuss how COVID recovery and the future for European institutions, as well as the DMI symposium on the 28th and 29th of April, which brings together the great and the good in the digital money and technology sphere. So it's definitely one to watch. We will, of course, be continuing our wide coverage of Asia and the US with Fed presidents and the Treasury from Japan, and the discussions on China as well really lead the OMFIF coverage. We have our big annual report along with the Gender Balance Index. The other index that we do is the Global Public Investor, which features findings from the most comprehensive worldwide survey of public sector investors. This will come out in June, so another one to watch. And the DMI research papers will have a fair few to be published in June, looking at public versus private blockchain, central bank and digital currency more broadly as well, looking at the private sector involvement in those discussions. So that goes hand in hand with the DMI symposium that we have coming up. So I think that this podcast has had a look back. Thank you so much, Natalia, for joining me. Is there anything that you think I is missing from what is coming up in the next few months?
No, I think we just covered it all. And thank you very much for having me in this podcast.
Well, thank you so much. And thank you all for listening. If you have any questions, always do email inquiries@omfiv.org. And we are very pleased to engage with the audience. So thank you, everybody.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the OMFIV podcast.